It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
In small claims court, in 95% of the cases, we try the case that day. Sometimes the defendant will come in and say they have an attorney. We have to take the case off of that docket and put it on the regular docket of the court. That would cause us to give you a trial date sometime in the future. Sometime a defendant can't be there. They're sick or they have some emergency, and they inform the court of that, and the judge will set it up for another date. But unlike the regular division of the court, where if a case is contested, we set it off for a contested trial, it is our intention to try the cases on the date that you come to court for small claims court, if it's humanly possible.
The Honorable Robert Pastilnik, City of Richmond General District Court Judge, reveals the ins and outs of the Small Claims Court, often called the People's Court, in the 100th original broadcast of this program. And during this week's question and answer session, we list the perfectly legal methods you can use to get out of a payday loan. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 100, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Yield spread premiums is what lenders call them. Consumer groups call them kickbacks. They're the cash that mortgage brokers or lenders get for steering a borrower into a home loan with a higher interest rate. And they are no small thing. The subprime mortgage market, where people with blemished credit borrow and where most predatory lending occurs, is a $500 billion a year business. As many as 90% of subprime loans involve kickbacks, with borrowers paying an average of $1,850, making these kickbacks by far the largest source of compensation for brokers. By one estimate, yield spread premiums cost borrowers $3 billion a year. But last month, the Federal Reserve Board issued final rules on mortgage originator compensation and anti-steering. The new rules say that a loan originator can't get paid more based on a loan's interest rate or other loan terms. The rule also strengthens protections against steering borrowers into bad loans. Even though the new rule comes too late to avert the crisis we're still dealing with, overall it goes far in ensuring that future home loans will be priced more fairly. Brokers can no longer legally receive more pay for higher interest rates or riskier terms. In other news, although an adoption usually cuts off all contact and communication between a child and a biological parent whose parental rights have been terminated by a court, that no longer has to be the case in Virginia. As of July 1, 2010, in any proceeding for an adoption, the birth parent and adoptive parent may voluntarily enter into a post-adoption contact and communication agreement, also known as a PACA, which is part of a new trend called open adoption. A PACA may include any type of contact, communication, and/or information sharing agreed upon by the parties. A PACA must include the birth parent's acknowledgement that the adoption is irrevocable even if the adoptive parent fails to abide by the terms of the PACA. A PACA also must include the adoptive parent's acknowledgement that the birth parent can enforce the provisions of the PACA in court. About half the states now have a statute that officially allows for a post-adoption contact and communication agreement and a mechanism for enforcing it. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answers to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Which two protections do Virginia employees have? A. You can't be forced to work on your day of rest. B. You can't be forced to pay for a medical exam needed for your job. Or C. You can't be forced to work overtime. The correct answers are A. You can't be forced to work on your day of rest. And B. You can't be forced to pay for a medical exam needed for your job. An employer can require you to work overtime, but must pay you time and a half for every hour over 40 hours worked in a week. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz, Is That Legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
It's time for this week's question and answer, and we're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
David from Mechanicsville.
Well, welcome to the show, David. What's our topic for this week?
Payday lending. What happens if I've overextended myself on payday loans? What's my next step? How do I correct the problem? What am I going to do to get out of the situation without damaging myself any further credit-wise or credit history-wise?
The General Assembly has put some protections. Basically, a payday loan can't be more than $500. You can't have more than one payday loan at a time, and the payday loan has to be for at least 14 days. It also has to be for at least double your normal, quote, pay period. So if you get paid weekly, the loan has to be 2 weeks. If you get paid every 2 weeks, the loan has to be for 4 weeks. If you get Social Security and you get paid monthly, then the loan has to be for 2 months. And you have to have at least one waiting day between ending one payday loan and starting the next payday loan. There also are limits on how many payday loans you can have during a 180-day period. You can only have five, and then if you want to get a sixth, you have to wait another 45 days. The other thing that the General Assembly did was they allowed what we call an extended payment plan. And this is one of the options that you have if you've got a payday loan and you can't pay it. If you can't pay the loan back on time, but you think you may be able to pay it in the future, then the payday lender has to offer an extended payment plan if you ask for one on or before the loan's due date. And that extended payment plan has to allow you to repay the loan in four equal installments over at least 60 days. There's no additional interest or charges during that extended payment plan, and you can't have more than one extended payment plan in any 12-month period. Moreover, if you enter into an extended payment plan, you have to wait 90 more days after paying back the payday loan before you can take out another payday loan. But another option that we suggest to people, especially if you're going to really have difficulty paying it back under one of these extended payment plan, is don't pay it back, stop payment on the check, and you can even make sure all of your other checks on the account are good and paid, and then close the account on the check that you gave to the payday lender. This is perfectly legal. It is not criminal. You won't be arrested. It doesn't violate the law. And in fact, what this does is it forces the payday lender, who's now got your check that is no good because you stopped payment on it and or closed the account, it forces the payday lender to simply bring a lawsuit against you, and they can sue you and they can get a judgment against you, which is nothing more than a piece of paper at the courthouse that says you owe someone a certain sum of money. The judgment is going to get interest at the rate of 6% per year, which is the judgment interest rate. But if you keep rolling over that payday loan over and over and over again, or enter into an extended payment plan, your interest is going to be that 362% to 724%. Does this sound like possible options in your situation?
Very much so. I appreciate your time and energy and effort on this. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Take care. We are here at the John Marshall Courthouse, and we are speaking with the Honorable Robert Pastelnik. He is a judge of the City of Richmond General District Court, and we are going to be speaking about small claims court today. Welcome to the show, Your Honor.
Thank you for having me.
Briefly, give us an overview of what is the small claims court.
The small claims court is the people's court. It's a special court set up by the legislature for people who are filing suits without attorneys and who expect that the other side will not be represented by attorneys, where they can come into court in an informal manner and have their cases heard. The jurisdictional limit of the court is $5,000. That is, you can't win a case for more than $5,000 in the small claims division, or even sue for more than $5,000, while in our general district court, in other cases, you could sue for up to $15,000. The cases are heard very informally, no rules of evidence, and the judges are expected to make decisions the same day based upon the evidence that's provided right there at trial.
Now, these cases, I gather, are filed in the same court with the same clerk's office and heard by the same judges in the same courtroom as the regular division of the General District Court.
That's correct. The only difference is we have a special window in the clerk's office for people who want to file their case in the small claims division.
So if someone wanted to file in the small claims division, what's the first thing they need to do? What information do they need to bring?
They need to know the defendant's name. They need to know the defendant's address. It's extremely important that they know where the defendant can be served. If the defendant does not have a home address, they could conceivably serve the defendant at work, but they have to have a physical place where the defendant can be served under the rules or laws of the Commonwealth.
Not a post office box.
Not a post office box.
And what if you're suing a business?
If you're suing a business, and the clerks will help you a little bit with that, although our clerks are not allowed to give legal information to anybody, they'll help you a little bit with that. You have to know what kind of business it is, whether it's a corporation, whether it's a partnership, whether it is an individual trading in a business name, or one of the more exotic forms of business like an LLC or a PLLC. And if it is a corporation, if it is an LLC, you have to get some information as to who the principals are or who the people who can be served with process are.
How would you get that information?
You can get that. You can get the information from the State Corporation Commission as to whether or not the business is a corporation or a LLC. If there's nothing at the Corporation Commission, you can usually go to the Business License Bureau in the jurisdiction in which the business is located, and they will usually have some information concerning the ownership of any particular business.
Okay, so you have the defendant's name and address. Is there a filing fee to file a case in the small claims division?
There is a filing fee, and the filing fee is the same as it would be for filing a claim in the regular division of the court. I think that if there is only one defendant, I think that it's now approximately $60 to file a suit, and for each additional defendant that you need to have served, it costs you an additional $12 to have process served.
Now, what if you can't afford that filing fee? What do you do then?
If you can't afford the filing fee, you tell the clerks that, and they will ask you a few questions about you and your income. And if you come within the range of what the Supreme Court feels is a person who should be able to pursue a case without a filing fee, they'll come back to the judge, and the judge will generally approve filing without paying a fee. It happens only in a very, very few cases, because filing a suit should be important to somebody. And if it's a matter of, well, I would rather go to the movies than pay the money to file the suit, and you're able to do one or the other, we're not going to let you file it for free. If it's a matter of, I would rather eat than file the suit, we're going to let you file it for free.
That's a good way to describe it. So the person bringing the lawsuit has now located the defendant's name and address. They've filed the lawsuit. What happens next?
They come in here and they fill out a form which has the information on it that the court is going to need to know what kind of case it is. It says how much they're suing for. Remember that the most that they can sue for is $5,000, whether or not they're asking for interest and from what date they're asking for interest, and what court costs they've expended. They fill out several copies of that. They give it to the clerk, and the clerk will then docket the case and send the extra copies down to the sheriff so that the sheriff can serve the defendant and let the court know that the defendant has been served. And once you've done that, if the defendant is properly served, the clerks will tell you what days the court meets for small claims. You'll pick a specific date, and you'll come into court on that date ready to go before the judge and present your case.
And how soon after the case is filed and served is the plaintiff going to have a trial in small claims court?
Generally, it's about 30 days. If there's an emergency, you can do it a little bit quicker if you can make sure the sheriff gets the papers right away. But generally, you need about 30 days from the time that you file it to the date that you pick to return, so the sheriff will have time to go down, find the people, and serve them.
And I gather there is no postponement, no continuance. You come to court on your trial day, ready to try the case?
In small claims court, in 95% of the cases, we try the case that day. Sometimes the defendant will come in and say they have an attorney. We have to take the case off of that docket and put it on the regular docket of the court. That would cause us to give you a trial date sometime in the future. Sometime a defendant can't be there. They're sick or they have some emergency, and they inform the court of that, and the judge will set it up for another date. But unlike the regular division of the court, where if a case is contested, we set it off for a contested trial, it is our intention to try the cases on the date that you come to court for small claims court, if it's humanly possible.
Now, what if the plaintiff bringing the lawsuit wants to have witnesses in court on the trial date or documents? What should they do in advance?
They should bring their witnesses with them to court. If they're worried about whether a witness will come to court, they should file a subpoena in the clerk's office. It costs $12 to file a subpoena, but it's worth it because, generally speaking, if you don't have a witness there, even if the witness has promised you that the witness is going to come in, we don't continue the cases. Both for the plaintiff and for the defendant, we try to try the cases on the return date.
So tell us about the trial. How does it work when you are hearing cases in the small claims division? You've got two people in front of you. They're both unrepresented. How do you handle it generally?
I explain to them, and the other judges here explain to them, that what we do is we put the plaintiff on one side, the defendant on the other side. We let the plaintiff tell everything the plaintiff wants to tell us. We let the defendant answer. If the plaintiff feels that it's necessary to speak again, we'll give the plaintiff that opportunity. But what the plaintiff is then doing is the plaintiff is rebutting something that might have been told to the plaintiff or told to the court by the defendant. But if we give the plaintiff an opportunity to speak one more time, we'll give the defendant an opportunity to speak one more time, and then we'll decide the case. We don't allow the parties to argue with each other in court. We don't allow them to make noises or distract the other party. We ask them to stand there like a lady or gentleman in court, listen, tell us what they want to tell us. We'll hear everything that they have to say, and then we'll decide the case based upon the evidence that they give to us.
And what about documents and papers? I mean, generally in the regular division of general district court, documents aren't used unless they meet some sort of a hearsay exception. I gather that's not the rule in the small claims division.
In small claims court, documents can be introduced. It's up to the judge to decide both whether a document should be introduced or whether it is a document which has no bearing on the case or not. And it's also up to the judge to decide what legal weight to give that document as opposed to testimony from another person. Obviously, if one party has a document and it refers to some facts, the judge can only see what's in the document. If the other party has a witness and that witness can say something about those facts, the judge has to give consideration to what the witness says about those facts. So it's better to have a witness, but documents are admissible. And if you have documents that will help prove your case, if the other side is trying to say that they're not responsible, those documents are most helpful to you and to the court, because it is always the plaintiff's burden to prove its case by a preponderance of the evidence.
Now, once the judgment has been issued, can it be appealed?
Yes. Both parties, if you lose your case or if you don't win as much as you expected to, either party has the automatic right of appeal to circuit court. In order to appeal to circuit court, the party must, within 10 days of the date of the decision, go next door to the clerk's office and file a written notice of appeal. The party must also pay the cost of sending the case up to circuit court, which now is about $130. And if the defendant loses or if there is a money judgment against either party, that party must also post a bond. That bond must be posted within 30 days, and the bond will be in an amount sufficient to satisfy the judgment if they lose again in circuit court.
And a judgment from the Small Claims Division, is that as good as or the same as a judgment in the regular division?
It's exactly like a judgment in the regular division. You can collect it all of the same ways you can collect a judgment. You can appeal from it, or it can be appealed just like any other judgment. Any what are called post-trial motions that would be available to somebody on the regular docket of the court or available on the small claims docket.
And one final question. I know that people who come to the Small Claims Division, at least a few of them, have gotten requests from TV judges, Judge Judy, Judge Harris, to appear on their shows and take their cases there. What's the difference, what's the similarity between the Small Claims Division and Judge Judy or Judge Harris?
Judge Judy, Judge Harris, Judge Brown, they have people who come to the clerk's office of courts like ours and look through the small claims docket to see if there are cases that look interesting that might be interesting for the people who view their shows to see them. If you get a letter like that, if both parties agree to go on the show, as I understand it, this is how it works. They'll bring you down there at their expense. They'll put you up in a hotel. I think that they pay you the actor's equity for being on the show for that day. They hear the case. And if the plaintiff wins, it's my understanding that they pay the judgment. It's a very interesting way to do this. What it is actually is mediation, because when they are on those shows, even though they're judges, or at least they were judges at one time in their career, when they are on that show, they are mediators or arbitrators. They are not judges in that they do not have jurisdiction in that court for any state, including the state in which their microphones and their cameras are located. That's theater, but it's intelligent theater. It's interesting theater. And if you are a defendant in one of those cases, if both parties agree to be bound by their rules, you probably should go, because even if you lose, they're going to pay the judgment for you. The only downside, either for the plaintiff or the defendant, is that obviously you have an opportunity to make a fool of yourself before a very, very substantial listening audience or watching audience.
That is a fascinating insight. We have been talking with the Honorable Robert Pastelnik. He is a judge from the City of Richmond General District Court, and we have been talking about the Small Claims Division of the General District Court. Thank you, Your Honor, for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's time for our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. which two types of family law cases can be handled only in circuit court and not in juvenile and domestic relations court? A. Spousal support. B. Division of marital property. Or C. Divorce. If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. What if you had to take a case to court and couldn't get before a judge? It's not just speculation, it's happening now. Join us next week when private attorney Irv Blank, president of the Virginia State Bar, talks about the looming and alarming judicial vacancy crisis in Virginia and why it might get worse before it gets better. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.